Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been about 20 years since New Hampshire's Libertarian Party has had a gubernatorial primary. But this year, running on the Libertarian ticket are two candidates, Aaron Day and Jaletta Jarvis. Today in The Exchange, we sit down with these two candidates and hear their ideas for governing the state. And let's hear from you, too. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And our candidates are, as I said, Aaron Day. He's former chairman of the Free State Project and the Republican Liberty Caucus of New Hampshire. Aaron Day has been involved in a number of businesses, calling himself a serial entrepreneur. And Mr. Day, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Jaletta Jarvis. Until recently, she worked as a regulatory learning project manager for J.P. Morgan Chase. She describes herself as a middle-class wife and mother from Sandown with a career emphasis on training and management. And Jaletta Jarvis, it's good to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, both of you, I'll start with you, Ms. Jarvis. What's the role of state government as you see it?
The role of state government is to, in my opinion, help the people of the state in supporting life, protection of property, and the equality of the pursuit of happiness.
And what isn't the role of the state?
Anything that overreaches those three items.
For example, yeah.
For example, I believe that when the state is determining which companies succeed or fail by handing out tax money to certain businesses, for example, when we've had bailouts of companies or that sort of thing, is overreaching in the terms of government.
So you're referring to most recently the assistance that the Regenerative Medicine Institute in Manchester is probably going to get from the state government?
Yes.
That's an example.
Yeah. I believe that we really need to be allowing our people in the state to determine which businesses are ones they want to support. And if people don't want to support a business, there's a reason for it, and we should find out what that reason is before we just throw money at it.
So that might also include the biomass controversy up north, whether we should support these biomass plants or not.
There is a lot that should have been done regarding the biomass companies. We were stuck in a situation where do we give money to support these small businesses, or could we change our regulations that are keeping them from being effective? For example, if we are making it so that the only people who can deliver energy are the top four energy providers in the state, we are keeping our smaller energy companies like the biomass companies from being able to compete in the industry. And those regulations are keeping those industries down.
Well, so those are some specific examples of the broad principle that you lay out, Ms. Jarvis. And same question for you, Mr. Day. Broadly first, the role of state government as you see it, and then a couple examples.
Well, I think the role of the state is to protect the rights of the people, first and foremost, not to solve people's problems. And so I think defending the Constitution within the state and then defending the state from encroachment from the federal government is the key role of the state. And I think in New Hampshire, we've gotten way out of alignment and way out of whack. We have increased spending tenfold in the last 30 years. And if you compare the rate of spending to the population growth, we've been spending at 30 times the rate that the population has been growing. And we're now at a point where our budget is 30% dependent upon the federal government, specifically through Medicaid. And so we have a situation where our solvency and sovereignty is at risk. So we need to go back to defending the rights of the people of New Hampshire, and we need to fix our financial problems before they become catastrophic.
So state government spending growing rapidly at a time when the population is not growing rapidly. Give us an example or two, Mr. Day, of state government programs that you think we just should not be funding.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the budget, there are two areas that drive almost two-thirds of spending, and it's education and healthcare. And so I think that at one level, we should be, and I, you know, I'd be a strong advocate for getting the state out of education and pushing that back onto the local communities. When you look at schools in particular, we've had a 20% decline in enrollment in public schools, yet spending has surged. And we're anticipating an even smaller number of enrolled students over the next decade, and yet there's absolutely no indication that costs are in any way going to be in line. And the same is true with healthcare. With healthcare, it just keeps on mushrooming. I think we saw a 44% increase in health insurance premiums, and that's largely because we've become more dependent upon the federal government to subsidize healthcare. When the federal government pays for healthcare, they don't reimburse at the rate that healthcare services actually cost, which causes the hospitals and the healthcare providers to have to increase what they charge the rest of the consumers. And so those two areas are the biggest areas where we need more localization, and we need more free market growth and opportunity.
Healthcare, education, regulation, the role of state government, that's what we're talking about today in the exchange with the two libertarian candidates for governor, those issues and a lot more. We're getting their thoughts on how they see the role of the governor here in the state. And we're taking your questions and comments. Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. The two libertarian candidates for governor this year, Aaron Day and Jaletta Jarvis. We welcome your questions at exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Before we get into some of these issues that you guys raise, you know, education, regulations, and so forth, libertarians often describe themselves as upholding individual liberties against what they deem to be government overreach. And Mr. Day, you expressed this. So given that point of view, what makes you want to even be a part of the system?
Well, I'm a serial entrepreneur, and that actually, as you mentioned at the beginning, I actually started my first company when I was 19. And there's nothing more exciting than building something from scratch, working voluntarily with people. And, of the numerous companies that I've either started, invested in, et cetera, I started one in the healthcare space in 2004. It was very profitable, very successful, and it was essentially dismantled by Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, and an overzealous attorney general, Eric Holder, at the time. And so I've seen what happens. You know, there are a lot of people that say, well, just don't vote. Just ignore the system. But the problem is that will land you in jail. You can't ignore government as much as you may try to ignore government. And so for that reason, that's actually what sparked me getting into politics and activism, was what I saw happen to my own company by the unintended consequences of legislation and regulation.
Frustration with regulation led you to decide to run for governor.
Well, it's frustration. I mean, well, it's not just run for governor. It's get involved in activism in general. I mean, as you mentioned, I've been involved with the Free State Project, the Republican Liberty Caucus. I was the CEO of the Atlas Society, which is a think tank that was based in D.C., although I remained here in New Hampshire. It's to promote the ideas of liberty in a variety of different formats, of which politics is one of those areas. And we've gotten to the point right now where what I've seen with the two political parties is a duopoly that, in fact, in this state for the last 30 years, you really have two families, the Sununus and the Shaheens, that have been kind of driving politics from the top down. And when you really dig into it, what you find is a lot of our politics, even at the state level, is still driven by the top down.
Even though other people hold the key offices like Hassan and Lynch and, you know, other names, Ginta.
Well, I mean, Ginta did. But I mean, I think, you know, Shaheen was Hassan's mentor. And so if you actually go through and look at this, I mean, I'll tell you, Molly Kelly is going to win the primary. This is just the way that the machine politics works here. So I think that duopoly needs to be broken, which is why I'm running as a libertarian, because I see no way out through the broken two-party system.
How about you, Ms. Jarvis? Again, you know, you're running for governor. but libertarians often chafe at government regulation. So why be part of governing if you don't like government?
Well, a lot of libertarians are for smaller government, not for the disillusionment of government. And I believe in a smaller government being more efficient, more streamlined, is more effective. And I also believe that we can promote our efforts through volunteering and through being part of the system to support that. For example, I've done a lot of volunteering with people who are homeless, with our veterans, with people who have food needs, people who are on welfare, small business owners who need to learn more about what their rights are, what the regulations are that govern what they have to do, and with people who are struggling with DCYF. And you can't just fix those from standing on the sidelines. You have to actually be part of it to help those regulations to either lessen or to grow in support of the people. And by just sitting back and not trying to be part of the solution, you just allow things to continue to crumble or continue to fall apart. But if you step forward and say, well, look, if we work together, if we build bridges between all of the parties and bring everyone together to the table, we bring the people who are actually affected by these issues, and we listen to them, and we find out where the problems are, where is the breakdown, and then we can work to build from there. And so I'm running and to be part of the system so that I can be part of that solution, because I don't want to sit back and just, oh, somebody else will handle it. Somebody else will jump in. Well, you know, I'm 43 years old and I still see problems that need solutions, instead of just pointing out, yeah, there's a problem here, there's a problem there. We need to start working towards the solutions towards those things. And that's what I wanted to come in and do.
We're hearing from our listeners, so let's go to some of their questions and comments. And Daryl sent us an email. And by the way, his email says he's chair of the Libertarian Party in Western New Hampshire. Daryl says, for both candidates, why should libertarians vote for you in September to represent the party in the general election? And Daryl, thank you for the question. And Ms. Jarvis, go ahead, you first. Why you?
Well, I believe that I represent a more compassionate and caring side of the Libertarian Party. People look at our party sometimes and think of us as the organization of rich white men, though, of course, I really have no idea which libertarians they've met, because I haven't yet met those ones. I actually go out there and I've met with the people and I've talked to them and I've worked with people. I've gone to court with people. I've gone and spoken to different agencies for the people. And this is something that, as a person who believes in transparency, as a person who believes in streamlining that budget, that I would continue to do after being elected, that I want the people in the state to come first, and that when they elect me, that this is something that I would carry through, that people would have the ability to come and talk to me at any time. I hold a weekly Facebook Live session. That's something I vowed to continue after being governor, so that people can talk to me about issues and tell me what the actual problems are that they face from the ground up.
So to answer Daryl's question, you would say elect me, libertarians listening right now, because I'm a compassionate libertarian.
I am, yes.
How about you? How would you answer that question from Daryl? Thank you, Daryl, for the email.
Well, I would answer the question in the sense that I think we're all concerned about the future. I mean, we're all concerned about our kids. We talked about that at the very beginning. We're at a point right now where we've had 2 years of declining life expectancy. We're at a point where our children might actually have a less productive future than we do and live shorter lives. And this requires to fix this requires a vigorous defense of our rights. And I believe I've demonstrated as an activist over the last 5 years that I'm a fighter. I mean, through various forms of activism and everything that I've gone through, I've, you know, everything from being sued to having film crews in my, you know, in my yard, to having, you know, people from the AG's office serve my 3-year-old son a subpoena wanting to know all of the information about the people that I'm connected to politically, which I didn't give them, by the way. I've continued to fight. and will continue to fight if I'm elected, because the reality is that, you know, again, as I said, the duopoly
the
two political parties are basically just collections of special interests and protected classes looking to maintain their own power. And so you need somebody that can go in there and fight and negotiate. And what I've done is I've put together an explicit contract with New Hampshire to specifically define what issues I'm going to deal with and the priority of those issues. And the three biggest issues that we're facing are the size of the budget, repealing Medicaid expansion, and fixing our pension system. And without doing something like I'm trying to do by getting a direct mandate from the people, the two parties will never address these situations and we'll find ourselves in financial ruin.
So thank you, Darrell, for the email. And since you mentioned, Mr. Day, that you're a fighter, I did get an email sort of toward that end from Victoria in Northwood, who says, I hope you will ask Aaron Day some probing questions about his deep affiliation with the Free State Project. Please ask him what his true motives are in running for office. Victoria says, from the outside, it seems like his intent is to sow chaos and to serve as a role model for other Free Staters wanting to do the same. Now, since you mentioned the suit, Victoria also says, please ask him what his purpose was in aligning himself with Michael Gill. Just to let our listeners know, Mr. Gill was found guilty of defamation for language on three billboards, including a well-known one in Manchester. So do you want to just take the opportunity to answer her question and clear that up?
Sure. I mean, I did move here as part of the Free State Project. And as you know, I mean, NHPR, you guys did that little bracket poll. I think we conceded, the Free State Project conceded to live free or die as kind of what is peak New Hampshire. I don't think the Free State Project is this renegade organization that's come in to colonize New Hampshire. I think the exact opposite. New Hampshire was the freest state in the country before the Free State Project moved here.
That's what attracted you guys to our state.
So if anything, I think that, you know, I classify the Free State Project as keeping New Hampshire live free again. That's really it. There's no subversive motive to it. And, you know, I signed a statement of intent, and that statement of intent said, you know, that I'm going to work to build a community where the maximum role of government is the protection of life, liberty, and property, which I think is in line with not only the Libertarian Party, but I think it's in line with the views of most of the people of the state. The alignment with Mike Gill, to be very clear, Mike was found guilty. I was not found guilty. And I think, you know, they weren't my billboards, and I have admitted no guilt. I think the idea, the way that association works here is a little bit interesting. I think I got dragged into the lawsuit, you know, frankly, from my perspective to try to keep me out of politics, which, you know, that obviously didn't work.
How do you feel about the Free State Project, Ms. Jarvis?
I think New Hampshire is an amazing state, and I completely understand why anyone would want to live here. I've lived here almost all of my life since I was 6 years old, and we actually lived here before that. But I've met a lot of the Free State Project people, and I think that everyone that I've met has been very dedicated and to their families, to privacy, to being part of solutions where they can, though a lot of the people I've met have not really involved themselves in politics as well. Though most of the Free State Project people I've met are actually running for, if they're running for office, are running as either Republicans or Democrats. Not a lot of them are actually in the Libertarian Party. So I know many of them. I think everyone I've met is wonderful, very caring people, but I'm not really in on the structural organization or...
So you haven't been involved as much in the Free State Project.
No.
All right, coming up, we'll talk more about regulations, since both of you mentioned that, including environmental regulations. We'll also talk about gun policy. That has been an issue in many campaigns this year. And a little bit later on, we'll talk about the opioid crisis here in New Hampshire, as both of you know, big, big problem. And both of you, not surprisingly for libertarians, support legalizing marijuana, so we'll talk about that as well. And we'll keep taking your calls, questions, emails. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's a conversation with the Libertarian gubernatorial candidates. It's been many years since New Hampshire had a Libertarian Party primary, but this September, Libertarians do have a choice. Aaron Day and Jaletta Jarvis are both on the ballot. You can email us your questions for them at exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Both of you talked earlier about reducing regulations in the state, and I wanted to ask you about a particular form of regulations, and that has to do with environmental regulations. Residents in different parts of the state, as I'm sure you both know, have had serious concerns about water contamination. Merrimack residents, for example, who live near the St. Gobain Plastics Factory, people on the seacoast, people discovering their wells are contaminated with suspected carcinogens. To you first, I think, Mr. Day, what's the role of regulations here in preventing or remediating these situations? It's very scary for people.
You know, these are scary issues, and obviously our environment, our water, air, et cetera, is important to the protection of life, liberty, and property. I think part of the confusion is, and this is often a reaction that says, well, there's a problem, the government needs to solve it, or there needs to be a regulatory body in place. And if you look at the EPA, also the FDA and the SEC, you see a common theme, which is you see this concept of regulatory capture, where the people that are involved in those regulatory agencies have a revolving door with the corporate interests that are the ones alleged to be polluting. And that's something that has not gotten any better over time. You can look at the financial crisis and see, you know, I mean, frankly, that we're, you know, on the cusp of another financial collapse, sovereign debt crisis. We haven't really even fixed the mortgage crisis. If you look at biotech companies, some of the most highly paid positions in a biotech company are people that are working on FDA regulation that come from the FDA. I think the best way to address these environmental issues is to have a strict enforcement of property rights and strict liability from that perspective. I don't think businesses set out. I mean, there's this image that businesses want to pollute, that their desire is to damage the environment and be completely reckless, which is exactly the opposite of how entrepreneurship works. I mean, you don't have a desire to poison your customers or damage the community. That's just fundamentally not good for business. And so I think if you make it all about property rights and liability, then that opens a marketplace for insurance, and that you can regulate these issues more effectively through the free market than you can by over-regulation on the other side.
So once the well is poisoned, so to speak, what happens then to at least remediate, and could regulations have prevented that poisoning, that contamination?
I don't know if the regulations necessarily would have prevented the contamination, but the potential liability would be more of a driver for the business.
I see. You're saying it would make businesses more cautionary.
Business would be more cautionary if they knew that they had strict liability. So, I mean, that kind of takes the motivation off of the table. And then, you know, so from that perspective, rather than try to add a bunch of red tape from the very beginning, that actually makes it very difficult up front to even start a business to try to deal with this red tape if people just have an awareness of the fact that, yeah, I will be held liable if I do these types of things, then I think that will serve as a proper motivator.
What do you think, Ms. Jarvis? Again, environmental contamination, water contamination has been a big issue in this year's New Hampshire elections. A lot of people, especially those who live in these areas, are quite upset.
Yeah, I've actually spoken to someone who lives out in Rye about the contamination that's happened there. I live in southern New Hampshire. Our well, because we have a well, has not yet been contaminated, but, we're close enough. I used to work for the Audubon Society for about 7 years. My grandfather was the vice president of the Audubon Society in Massachusetts. So I grew up spending my summers with them and going out and dealing with issues that he had to go and investigate. And so, unfortunately, I've seen some of the problems, you know, the oil and all of that on animals up front and face to face. And I agree that no company goes out, starts setting up, oh, I'm going to pollute, I'm just going to get. But unfortunately, apathy happens. And sometimes it's easier to look the other way. I mean, it happens in every industry. Unfortunately, when this industry becomes apathetic, people get hurt. And I believe that we need to start fixing the problems that's already in existence. I've been working with a gentleman who wants to start a company here on industrial hempcrete, which is a product made from hemp, which actually takes toxins out of the ground so we can start reversing the problems that we have, such as the ones at Rye or the ones that have been caused in wells near that have been affected by Saint-Gobain's. And you create this concrete and you make these forms and you put them out in the areas that are affected, and they actually draw the toxins out of the ground. Then you pick those forms back up. You take them back to what's called the slurry, and you break them up. You put them back in the mixture, and the toxins actually float out to the top. You scoop them up and dispose of them properly this time, and then you can reform the hempcrete back into the forms and put them back out to start the job all over again.
So focusing on your role as potential governor, who is responsible for making sure that happens? And ultimately, who is responsible for making sure that other areas do not face the same contamination problems? I'm trying to get to your philosophy of, like, responsibility, regulation, government, business, and so forth.
Well, I believe that it is the government's job to protect your property and your life. That those are two of the three things that I had said in the beginning were very important and were the role of the government. And so it is important that we enforce any inspections to make sure that pollution's not happening. We can catch it early. I believe that we should be enforcing or encouraging litigation, because these companies should be giving restitution to those people who have been affected. And like Mr. Day, I believe that that threat of the litigation and the lawsuits that follow will help to prevent future issues where people say, oh my gosh, we need to make sure we're not being apathetic in this situation. We need to make sure that we're following all of those regulations that are out there that say you're not allowed to just dump that anywhere you want to.
Well,
and yeah, I believe that there do need to be some regulations that say you can't just dump things into the water. You can't just send water back out unfiltered.
It's interesting, too, to hear about your background with the Audubon. I did not know about that. Let's go back to our listeners, both of you, and then I do want to ask you about licensing, guns, marijuana, a couple other issues. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're hearing from the two Libertarian candidates for governor this year, Jaletta Jarvis and Aaron Day, and we'd love your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Sarah's calling us from Concord. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling regarding the opioid crisis and its also effects of homelessness and affordable housing in New Hampshire. We are, as you know, very high for opioid overdose-related deaths. I believe, depending on the number, it's either number two or number three, depending on which list you look at, for how badly the state is affected by ODs. So I'm interested in hearing both candidates' approach to handling this crisis. And additionally, we have close to zero affordable housing available in New Hampshire. This is affecting employers and the homeless. So I'm interested in hearing more about zoning and density plans from both candidates, and I'll take my answers off the air.
All right, Sarah, thanks a lot. And Mr. Day, I'll start with you. Let's focus on opioids first, and huge, huge issue, Sarah, so thank you for raising it. What would be your response, Mr. Day, if you were elected governor to this opioid crisis?
Well, the opioid crisis, we do have the highest death rate, fentanyl death rate in the country per capita. And Manchester is on track to have its worst month for overdoses this month in July. And we continue to throw more and more money at treatment. I'm a proponent of treatment, but there's a big difference between treatment and government-funded treatment. And I think this has been the big issue. I know you guys at NHPR have covered a lot of some of the issues with the treatment centers, with claims of, you know, not handling billing practices properly or worse. There's a 40-year-old treatment center that was just shut down due to financial mismanagement, and it ran out of money. To me, we don't know what the solution is to the opioid crisis. Whenever you ask someone, obviously, as you look at the aggregate data, whatever we're doing isn't working. And what that suggests to me is we need to experiment. And when you're getting money from a federal agency, you don't really have a lot of leeway to experiment. Right now, if you want to spend money on treatment, you're pretty much confined to dealing with methadone or Suboxone or Narcan. I mean, they're pharmaceutical approaches. Or if you're doing a peer-to-peer approach, it's maybe based on a 12-step program. But those haven't necessarily moved the needle in a significant enough way. So I kind of like voluntary solutions for this. I would like to see private money come into this. There's a group called the Pineapple Fund that was started at the end of last year. A Bitcoin, you know, millionaire decided to put $55 million into a number of different charities. New Hampshire has a huge cryptocurrency community, which people aren't aware of, but we have. We have and we have a growing base of blockchain technology companies here. I think it would be interesting to get the government out of the way, stop the red tape and stop the pumping the money into the things that aren't working, and open it up to see what kind of private solutions we can come up with. But in addition to that, I'd say we need to end the failed war on drugs. We're, you know, 50 years and $1.5 trillion into that. That doesn't work. And we need to focus on decriminalizing this, because just throwing people in prison is certainly not a solution either. So you can start with that, but then I think open this up to private solutions as well.
Well, and more broadly, libertarians have long said the war on drugs has been a failure. But more specifically to what we're seeing right now, Mr. Day, you said, you know, get the government out of the funding because it puts too many restrictions on how the treatment is carried out. And we've certainly heard that criticism. What about folks who can't afford treatment? They have at least taken advantage of some of these public funds to help them pay for treatment. I just wonder what you think about that.
Well, they have. But again, it's not working in the aggregate. So this is the problem. People say, yes, there's a problem. And then they say, well, we have to do something. And that something now has turned into a $36 billion a year industry that's not getting the job done. So I'm actually suggesting, when I suggest private alternatives, I'm suggesting also, along with that, the crowdfunding of resources to help people that don't have the money to pay for it themselves. That's all encompassed within that. So I'm not suggesting get the government out of it and only people that can pay for treatment pay for treatment. I'm suggesting let's do a voluntary aid model where let's get folks together to both fund this privately and to test and experiment with different solutions.
The state is in line to receive about $45 million in federal funding over a two-year period to address the opioid crisis. Real quick, Mr. Day, because I do want to get you in on this very important question, Ms. Jarvis, as well. If you were governor, would you say yes or no to that money?
I would say no to this money. We have, just every man, woman, and child in the United States owes $900,000 in unfunded debt and liabilities. And so when a lot of time this gets presented as free money, it's not free money. This is money that our children have to pay back. And so if it's money that's being ineffectively spent, which again, we haven't seen the results that it works, then I'd say let's put that money back as we're running $1.1 trillion deficits, and let's start looking at private solutions.
It's not free money because it comes from taxpayers, basically.
Well, it comes from the children of taxpayers. I mean, it's beyond taxation without representation. You're going to need a time machine to figure out who's going to pay for Medicaid expansion and who's going to pay for these drug treatment programs.
What about you, Ms. Jarvis? Broadly, first, how would you address, if you were elected governor, this pretty terrible opioid epidemic that New Hampshire sees itself in? The numbers are staggering and very sad.
Unfortunately, I don't think this is a broad case solution. I think that this is a multi-step solution. The Cana Institute in Massachusetts has actually done a lot of research on the usage of cannabis as a way to get people off of opioid addiction. It's proven very successful. I think that legalization of cannabis actually would assist in this a great deal. And I believe also that if we start working on our economy, making sure that people, I know everybody talks about the fact that we have a low unemployment, but we also don't keep track of everybody who's actually unemployed. There are a lot more people unemployed in this state than people realize, and it's a lot harder to find jobs than people realize. But people who are depressed because they can't support their families, because they can't find a job, because they can't find housing, they are more likely to do drugs than people who are happy and employed and able to afford to support their families. We need to work on making sure there are more jobs out there than just retail or working at Dunkin' Donuts or working at, you know, those jobs that are earning you the minimum wage. we need to make sure that we do have access to health care all over the state. If you have to travel an hour to get to a mental health facility in the state, you are most likely not going to go. And I think that once we've legalized cannabis, then we need to take and all of the funds that are being used to incarcerate those people who are guilty of non-victim or, excuse me, are guilty of victimless crimes that are just cannabis users, we transfer those funds from incarceration to treatment. We make sure that people are being treated. And I've spoken to people who are medical professionals at treatment facilities, and they're not seeing the money. This treatment funds that are going out, this money that's supposed to be dedicated to treatment, they say they've never seen it.
Well, and this big federal grant isn't here yet. But yeah. Getting to your broader point about, you know, people who have good jobs and are feeling stable and have good housing maybe aren't as likely to be addicted. And you mm-hmm. said we need to make sure we have high quality jobs, access to health care. When you say we, who do you mean, Ms. Jarvis? Because you kind of sound like a Democrat there, to be honest.
Well, when I say we, I mean that by encouraging and taking some of the regulations out of place that are keeping people from coming here to work, that are keeping people coming here to have jobs.
I'm talking about licensure.
The entrepreneur, the occupational licensing, the high energy rates that are caused by over-regulation of the energy companies. These regulations are keeping businesses from coming here. The high property taxes. There are better places that they can go. There are many companies who have cited that the reason that they're leaving New Hampshire is because they just can't afford the energy rates on a factory. Six Hour was one of the companies who said that they were going to expand their company here in New Hampshire, but they just simply couldn't afford the energy rates on that much more space. So they sent it to another state. These are jobs that we're losing. And people think that the reason that we're losing them is because we don't have enough employees, but we still have a lot of employees who are looking for work. I talk to people every day who have been laid off and they can't find another job. I myself was laid off in March. It is not as easy as people think to put out a resume when you've had 20 years of experience in a field and not even get an interview at the time. Or the other things I'm hearing is they get an interview and they just never hear anything again. And it gets depressing.
So the
depressing.
Narrative we're hearing isn't quite accurate, you're saying.
Exactly.
You know, before we head into break, I did want to ask you very quickly the same question I asked Mr. Day. So again, state is in line, hasn't happened yet, to receive about $45 million in federal funding to address the opioid crisis over a two-year period. If you were governor, would you say yes or no to this money?
I would also say no. Because I don't believe that we need to become more dependent on the federal government. Every dollar that you get from the federal government comes with strings attached. And I believe that really we can solve this ourselves if we just start looking to solutions instead of constantly talking about the problem.
Well, thank you again for that call. Lots of important questions. We didn't even get to housing yet, but maybe we'll get to that after a short break. And we'll keep taking your calls as well. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, more with Aaron Day and Jaletta Jarvis, both candidates for New Hampshire governor on the Libertarian ticket this year. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I love all parts of NHPR.
As an NHPR underwriter, you can connect to a news service that is personally important to people across New Hampshire.
Something that connects me to my community, to my state, and it's an important part of my daily life.
And NHPR listeners support businesses that support their station.
We feel that NHPR is sort of part of our family. It's just part of our community.
To learn more about how to speak to NHPR's loyal, community-minded audience, go to nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, the author of a new book on Mount Washington called The White Mountain. That's Wednesday in The Exchange. Today, we're talking with the two Libertarian candidates for governor, Aaron Day and Jaletta Jarvis, and we're hearing from you. Send your email for the candidates to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Mr. Day, Ms. Jarvis, right back to our listeners. Jordan's calling from where? Hi, Jordan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question's for Aaron Day. I've been a lifelong Republican, and I'm not really super familiar with the Libertarian Party, but a lot of what you say I agree with. What's the difference between a Libertarian and a Republican?
Oh, it's a good question, Jordan, and one we get a lot, so I appreciate it. Go ahead. I'd like to hear from both of you, but go ahead, Mr. Day.
Well, the Libertarian Party is about protecting individual rights and frankly, defending people from the tyranny of the state. To be honest with you, I was a Republican for a while, and I can't tell you what a Republican actually means. There's what they say they mean, and then there's what they actually do. I used to think that Republicans were fiscally conservative until I realized that in this state, in New Hampshire, it's actually been the Republicans that have been driving the increase in spending over the last 30 years, as much, if not more, than the Democrats. So I would say if you're into individual rights, if you're into liberty and you're into limited government, we'd love to have you in the Libertarian Party.
Where would you say, just sort of bing, bing, bing on the issues, Mr. Day, that you agree with Republicans and where you agree with Democrats?
I mean, again, it's rhetoric or actual reality.
Because, yeah, rhetoric.
Because it has to be rhetoric. Because
they haven't lived up to their ideals.
I see them as
saying.
Indistinguishable at this point.
I see.
I mean, they're the same on all the big on the big issues. They both expand the welfare state. They both expand the warfare state. And here we are. I think conceptually Democrats are supposed to be more liberal on social issues, but I think that turns out to not even be the case either. I think the Democrats are more about creating protected classes so that they can create dependency instead of actually protecting people's individual rights. I'm still waiting for the Democrats to get around to judging people on the content of their character. And on the Republican side, you know, I'm still waiting to hear about where they're fiscally conservative. The Republicans borrow money from the future. The Democrats want to tax you now, but the Republicans are borrowing money from future generations. Neither of those things are acceptable. So all I can say is what I believe in, and what I believe in is the core libertarian principles. The rest of it's a mush.
Well, and Jordan, thank you for the question, and it's one probably a lot of listeners have. So Ms. Jarvis, I'll throw it to you as well. What's the difference between a Republican and a Libertarian?
Well, the Republican Party is based mostly on money. That's what the focus seems to be, is smaller government and that budget conservancy, which is something that the Libertarian Party agrees with. We want to see smaller government. We want to see you using less tax money. But we also believe in personal freedom in that minority of one, meaning we believe that there should be no grouping of people, that each person deserves the exact same rights. And we call it the minority of one because every single person should have the same rights. There should be no differentiating between people. We also believe in making sure that things like asset forfeiture should not exist. You shouldn't be taking property from someone without even convicting them of a crime. That civil asset forfeiture is something that we are very much against. Eminent domain. The Libertarian Party in New Hampshire is actually one of the groups that spearheaded the removal of civil asset forfeiture being used for private businesses here in New Hampshire in a case that was fought with the Supreme Court. That was done by the Libertarian Party.
So protection of private property from government.
Yep. And we also were the first ones to fight for anyone to be allowed to get married. The Democrats picked it up, but it's something that we were the ones who initiated. It was actually my Aunt Carla Howell who started fighting that in the during one of her campaigns down in Massachusetts.
About same-sex marriage.
About same-sex marriages, exactly.
Well, thank you for the question, Jordan. And here's one from John who sent us an email. John says, the suggestion to replace government funding for opioid treatment with private funding is disingenuous. John says, nothing is stopping private people from funding this care right now, but it isn't happening in anywhere the amount needed. John, thank you for the email. And Ms. Jarvis, to you first, what do you think?
I agree that we're not doing that right now. But I've been working with a company called We Do Better. And what that company does is it helps to make proposals to government for a tax credit for charitable donations. And it's worked in companies like in states like Arizona, in California. And we're working on how to arrange this in New Hampshire, where we have a different tax structure, and how to apply those tax breaks for property taxes and business taxes, so that people who are giving to charities, that approved in-state charities to help the people here where we need it, how to apply those tax breaks back, so that if we want to try to encourage those donations to different charities that can focus, because that's what their job is to focus in on that particular area, and that's an area that you feel more strongly in, that your tax dollars are basically going to either education or to homelessness or to veterans care or to the opioid addiction crisis. Those are things that we can incentivize you to give your charitable tax dollars, and it saves the state money in the long run.
Mr. Day, go ahead. I'd love for you to respond to John's email as well, since that was your point he's responding to.
Well, I don't think it's disingenuous at all. First of all, I think that the government is crowding out private investment. So, you know, when you're adding billions and billions of dollars to the debt and pushing it into one direction, that's money that the taxpayers don't have to make investment. But beyond that, one of the big issues is regulatory. Gilletta mentioned that cannabis has been shown to be a good treatment for the opioid crisis. There's one of the private charities that Pineapple Fund invested in was the use of MDMA to try to look at problems around PTSD and so on and so forth. So I think private money would want to go into solutions that could actually work. If you're constrained and you're not even able to try things that might work, then yeah, why would you dump money privately into the same things that don't work publicly?
What's MDMA? Pardon me?
It's essentially ecstasy. It's the same, you know, drug from that perspective. So, and it's been shown. It's had clinical effectiveness. In fact, it started out as a drug, and it used to be used to help couples that were having relationship issues, so on and so forth. But we can't even try those things. We can't even legally try things that might work. And we're forced to fit within this box of what's been deemed to be effective, which are these things that aren't really that effective. And so I say get that regulation out and get the government funding out, and I think you will see private funding come in and you will see experimentation.
I want to ask both of you about gun policy. That's been an issue in this year's campaigns, given the just horrifying tragedies that we've seen, these mass shootings in, you know, churches and schools and malls. And, you know, it's just been an issue that has been on a lot of our voters' minds. And I know both of you as libertarians are big Second Amendment people. So I just wonder what your approach would be. Mr. Day, I'll go to you first. You know, as governor of the state, what steps would you take to try to prevent the possibility of some mass shooting in New Hampshire?
Well, we haven't had a mass shooting in New Hampshire, and we have constitutional carry. So, I think, you know, if anything, we're leading on what should be done. If you look at the places where you are having these mass shootings, and you're looking at places where there's the most gun violence of all, like Chicago, these are the places that have the most restrictive gun laws. So, in one step, I think constitutional carry is the way to go. I think that, you know, schools should not be gun-free zones. I mean, again, I think this plays into you basically have a bunch of children that are sitting targets and unprotected. So, you know, it's, I guess, not a surprise that public schools end up being major targets for these types of things. Beyond that, I think one of the things that we can do is promote school choice. I think that's another way. And I'll explain how that works in a second.
I'm not talking about schools, though. I'm talking more broadly. I mean, you know, a school this week, a church last week, a concert next week. I mean, it's happened in all sorts of venues.
It has. And I believe constitutional carry and people being armed is the best defense. And again, you're not seeing those mass shootings here in New Hampshire. So,
well,
I think
in 1997, we did have a mass shooting up in Colebrook,
okay,
New Hampshire.
In 1997. So, but, you know, in general, we are one of the safest states in the country and have some of the best statistics with respect to gun violence.
What do you think, Ms. Jarvis?
Well, as many people who know me know this, I actually lost my own father to gun violence. And I truly believe that if he had been in a location where people were allowed to carry their own weapons, it wouldn't have just been the criminal in the location that had a weapon on him. I don't believe in promoting additional gun controls to what we have. I do agree with Mr. Day that it is constitutional carry that keeps us more safe. There was actually a Canadian comedian who I watched recently who said, why don't Canadians come in to do crime in America? And he said the reason why was because they don't know how many of us are actually armed. And if we go through and enforce additional age limitations, there are a lot of people right now who wouldn't have been alive in that situation. For example, the 18-year-old girl in Oklahoma who was a teenage mother. Her husband had just died from cancer. And on the day after his funeral, a man came knocking at her door. She wouldn't let him in. So 2 days later, he shows up again with another friend and a big knife and actually tries breaking down her door. She gets on the phone with 911. It takes 21 minutes before the police get there. And she finally ended up having to shoot the man after he broke into her home.
I'm sorry to hear about your father, Ms. Jarvis. I did not know about that. So this issue is personal.
It is very personal.
For you, and I understand that. I'm wondering what both of you think about the research showing that access to firearms increases the risk of homicide, a triple risk for suicide. There's a lot of attention now on gun-related suicide. This is data from the Annals of Internal Medicine, other studies from the FBI and the CDC, show that when you've got guns around, the chance of you being shot or a loved one being shot actually goes up. And I just wonder what you think, Mr. Day, first, please.
Well, I mean, again, I think the component to this, you know, with freedom comes responsibility. So I would encourage people to take personal responsibility. But I certainly wouldn't want to take away somebody's freedom just because, you know, a report suggests that there might be an adverse outcome. Certainly, you know, if you're going to have a gun, be responsible about it and learn how to use it.
Ms. Jeffers?
Honestly, I feel that statistic just kind of disingenuous in itself. If you have a gun around, you have a higher percentage of being shot with a gun. What's your percentage of being shot with a gun, I suppose, if there's no gun in the room? I mean, that it just seems a very bizarre statistic to even use. But yes, there are people who will use a firearm for suicide purposes. But people who really want to commit suicide, if they are not getting help and they are not getting treatment, will find another way to do so. And unfortunately, it might take longer. It might be worse for them. What we really need to be doing is not focusing on how they're committing suicide, but how we can prevent the need to commit suicide. I mean, if we just focus on the final outcome instead of focusing on the human need, I think we're focusing on the wrong thing.
Let's move on to one other issue, and then I want to close out by asking both of you what you would do on your first day if elected governor, priorities in office. But what about marijuana legalization? As you've alluded to, both of you, throughout the hour, you support legalizing marijuana. So I'm not going to say why, because I think you both made that clear. But we've spoken with a lot of people in recovery from opioid addiction, who've warned against legalizing marijuana. They've said, look, this is not the time to put another drug out on the market for people to access easily. This is not the way to go, especially where we're at now in terms of opioids. And Mr. Day, I think I'm going to let you take that one first, please. That legalizing marijuana is just not the way to go right now. We're in the midst of this opioid crisis.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, I believe in people's ability to make their own decisions. I'm not sure to what you're referring, but I haven't seen any real statistical evidence that suggests that marijuana, you know, this whole idea of it being a gateway drug or it being problematic.
It's a concern that we've heard expressed.
It's a concern, but it's not a concern backed up by, is there evidence? Because I haven't seen it. I've heard this concern before, and then I'm like, okay, well, where's the evidence? And there isn't any evidence. But again, this is about focusing on people's individual rights to decide what they're going to do with their own body. And, you know, and again, beyond that, there are medicinal purposes and uses for marijuana.
As we've seen with medical marijuana program expanding in the state. Go ahead, Ms. Jarvis.
I've actually seen a lot more evidence from scientific data, again, from the Cana Institute, from and other scientific research studies that were done on cannabis use that have found that, one, you you can't die from it. It's not one of those drugs that you take and now you have to worry about overdoses. And I've found the opposite in regards to the opioid addiction, that people who are on opioids can use it to get off of it, and it doesn't cause as high an addiction rate as your opioid drugs do. So people, the study that was done at the Cana Institute actually found that they were able to get people off of opioids and then off of the cannabis right afterwards.
Last question for both of you. And Ms. Jarvis, I'll go to you first on this one. Let's say you get elected. Priority. First day in office. What do you do?
Since the first thing on the agenda is actually the budget, the first thing to focus on is streamlining and making it more efficient. Get that budget down so that we're not charging as much money to our taxpayers.
Down by, like, you know, do you have a goal, like 50%? Or
I would like to keep working it down every single year. I believe that, you know, we've had a surplus. So why are we not giving that money back? You know, why are we continually saying, well, each year we can just brag about the fact that we have more money, but it's the taxpayers' money. It's not the state's money. So, yes, if we know that money is there, we could start giving it back.
Mr. Day?
Yeah, I mean, I would say
first day in office.
I mean, first day in office, you know, the same thing in the sense that, you know, I'd veto any budget that actually increases spending. So to kind of put that out there. But beyond that, I've put together this contract with New Hampshire, which I would promulgate on my first day so that everyone is fully aware of all of the different points. And you can see this on my website, day4nh.co. But the other two components of this are repealing Obamacare Medicaid expansion and fixing the pension system. Those are the top three priorities.
Okay. And we've got links on our website and so forth. You can also watch this interview on Facebook Live and check it out online on Facebook, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange for more information. And so on. And I want to thank both of you for coming in. I really appreciate it. Aaron Day, it was good to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Aaron Day, former chairman of the Free State Project and the Republican Liberty Caucus. And Jaletta Jarvis, good to meet you too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jaletta Jarvis, until recently, she worked with JP Morgan Chase. She's had a career emphasis on training and management. Both Jaletta Jarvis and Aaron Day are this year's Libertarian candidates for governor. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.